911, what's your emergency?
Yes, this is dispatcher Sue Blevins. I'm calling from Fields Market on 3rd and La Brea. I think I'm witnessing a kidnapping in progress.
Can you describe the assailant? Ma'am?
Sorry to be so disrespectful about the getting hit by a car.
Poor
of Sue Blevins in this
Sue
episode.
Sue Blevins. When I did it, I was making fun of the Phil Collins kid. You made fun of the legend, the diva, the icon herself, Sue Blevins.
The
let
real
the record
woman
show
really exists.
Let the record show. This Sue is Blevins. Jane's idea. I had a completely different idea, and she said, we're doing mine. And I said, you're right.
I didn't say we're doing mine. I said, I have an idea that I think you'll like, and you said, I'm down. So yeah, let the record show.
Unfortunately, I
anyway,
was fully complicit everybody, in this scheme.
Welcome back to the First Respodcast, you guys. And everybody sit down and shut the fuck up, because it's time for the Sue Blevins Star Vehicle episode,
yes.
Okay? It's time for the 911 Dispatcher Propaganda episode. It's
yes.
time for the Josh origin story episode.
Yes.
This is Josh Begins.
Josh
oh
begins.
My god, Josh Begins.
Josh Begins. Unfortunately, we can't call it that because we have another title picked out. But yes,
okay,
this
well,
is
Ryan
Josh
wants
begins.
To call the episode Diva Down, but
I'm
that
sorry,
is
it's
kind
just
of
the
generic,
most fitting
no
episode.
Offense, so.
It's the most fitting title. We have to go with it. Wait, what if it's Josh Begins and then in parentheses hashtag Diva Down?
Diva Down. And then in parentheses season 4 episode 11 First Responders, because we also put that in our titles.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, sounds like a good one. Really rolls off the tongue. Yes, today we're discussing season 4 episode 11 First Responders. Wow, this is the episode of the show with the title closest to the title of our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Now, when we were coming up with names for this podcast, we had several suggestions that were similar.
Dalmatians.
Which is the best title, and I stand by it's the one that I loved the most emotionally. It was also the first one I thought of. You thought of First Risk Podcast. You also thought of First Podcasters, which was
that one was stupider. I'm glad I got around to the other one.
It tickled me.
First Podcasters.
So, it tickled me.
The concept of us claiming to be the first podcasters.
Yeah. We threw in like a chimney sweep. And then I think I suggested I Know Why the Caged Buck Sings.
a title that I worried might be a little culturally tone deaf.
But, you know, also I thought it was very beautiful in like sort of a haunting way. So
it is haunting.
We'll have to work that in
eventually.
It does
also place a lot of emphasis on Buck, which, like, obviously we do place some emphasis on Buck, but I wouldn't really want us to name any one character in the title, because then it would seem like we're all about that one character.
Now that I've folded on Buddy and have fully jumped ship to the gay hockey show,
okay.
I am so glad we didn't call our podcast Buddies.
Well, I think it would have been too derivative of the Buddy System podcast anyway.
That
like,
as
there's
well.
Already a buddy focused podcast. They can have that one.
Mm-hmm. By the way, shout out to the Buddy System. Hi guys. How's it going?
Hi guys. I also think Buddies would have been too generic. It wouldn't have been very searchable. It wouldn't have been very good for our SEO. Not
yeah.
that our SEO is great now, because usually when you type First Respodcast into Google, it just thinks you've made a typo.
But it suggests a different one every time, which I appreciate.
And it is fun, because when we are like beefing with weird Buck Tommies on Twitter, they tend to get the name of our podcast wrong, because it's such a kind of unwieldy portmanteau of two
which is
words.
Insane, because we say at the end of every episode it's spelled how it sounds.
Spelled
like, what's
how
not
it
to
sounds.
Get about
yes.
that?
Anyway, today's episode was directed by Tasha Smith, who, interestingly enough, directed one other episode of the show, and it was Athena Begins. And I do feel like you can see some shades of that in here.
Yeah.
And as much as we're critical of Athena Begins, I don't think it's a badly made episode. So I'm down with Tasha Smith. This one was also written by old fan favorite Kristen Rydell and Nadia Abbas Madden. And I think the gals did a pretty good job.
Wait, hold on. Is this the Tasha Smith that I'm thinking of? Is this the Tasha Smith that I'm thinking of as... Wait, hold on. It is. Oh my God, it so is. It is Tasha Smith.
Yeah, she's also an actress.
She's an actress. So she was on Empire. She played Carol. But I know her specifically. This is a bit of Tasha Smith lore. She went to acting school with RuPaul.
Oh.
She went to acting classes with RuPaul. And so they go way back. And so when she was a guest judge on Drag Race in, I think, season 8, they did that insane lore drop on the Empire Challenge they did. that was fun. But yeah, shout out to Tasha Smith.
Wow.
Shout out to Tasha.
Excellent. How's Rue doing?
You know, how's Rue doing? How's Mama? Now, Tasha is an excellent actress and an excellent director. I actually think she's a tremendous talent. So, and you could see that coming through in this episode, even though there were some creative choices that I thought could be dialed back just a little bit.
well, right. And I have a couple, like, things to question about the writing of this episode, back to the writers. But I think it's a much less... much less morally complicated episode than Athena Begins.
Oh,
I'm mostly
certainly
on its side. There are just moments where you're like, should we unpack that? Why doesn't the show unpack that, etc.?
Yeah.
But I think we should just get right into it. Jump right into it.
Who wrote this episode again? Sorry, I missed it because I was Googling Tasha Smith.
Oh, fan favorite Kristen Rydell.
Oh, that's right.
And
that's
Nadia Abbas Madden.
That's right. That's right. I'm back. Okay, we're back. All right, so this episode opens at
Fields Market.
Organic grocery store, it seems like.
Ugh, if I lived in the 911 universe, I would be working in the deli of this grocery store.
And there's a man, and a man comes out and speaks to the security
guard.
And the man is Jerry / Gary from Parks and Rec. That's
is it
how...
genuinely the same actor? Because that's what I
it
thought.
Is.
And then I feel like when they showed his face in a different scene, I thought it was a different actor.
No, it's that's him. That's him. That's Jerry / Gary.
Okay.
I immediately clocked it because before I even watched Parks and Rec, my favorite show as a kid, staying up late watching Nick at Night, was George Lopez. And he was in like two episodes playing two different guys. And it's Gary. It's Gary. Is it Gary or Jerry?
Well,
is that a running bit
on the
show? I think
that's like part of the bit, maybe. Yeah.
But
basically, Jerry loves his wife. Sue
he
Lovin's
loves
husband
his wife.
Loves her. Because he gets out of the grocery store and he notices that they have daffodils outside, like for sale, and bouquets, her favorite flowers. So, you know, nice homegrown man, whatever his name is, says to the security guard outside, like, do you mind just watching my cart for a minute? These are my wife's favorite and she's waiting in the car. I want to surprise her. And security guard's like, okay, just this once, since you're such a sweet wife guy.
She fully doesn't watch it, by the way. She just keeps her back turned to the store.
No, she has her back to it.
She's like, anyone could take it. Oh, I guess there it goes. It's fine. This isn't my job.
But in the car, Sue is having a little call with Josh. We later find out she's on the phone with Josh. And she's being such a like morally upright dispatcher boss, because she's saying like she seems to be declining a request from some like councilman asking to come like do kind of a PR tour of the dispatch, and she's like, this is a workplace, we can't have people just parading in, it's not a tourist attraction, tell them no, Josh.
Well, it seems like this has been like sort of a conflict that has been bubbling up like with the mayor's office or something, that they want to like I guess get people informed about dispatch and like have it be like a cool like tour, like we see tours, like guided tours of the dispatch center, but it seems like they're looking to like expand
we
it
see
and
them
really
in
intrusive.
This episode,
I mean, we do see them in this episode, that's true. And it is kind of insane to think about the fact that there can even be like guided tours and visitors in like a very high energy place of work like that, where it's very serious and the entire city relies on it. Like that, I don't know.
If kids can come and tour like the fire station, it's not very different.
Well, this actually, I don't know how often they do this in other countries, because like I don't know if they still do, but they used to definitely give a lot of like guided tours of the White House and like other stuff like that. Have like sort of public, I mean, they used to, you know, before 9/11, they would let people come up and see the cockpit during flights, you know,
yeah,
and like hang
like
out with the
airplane.
Pilots. I don't know how much that is like a culture of other places, if that's less of a thing, if that's more of a thing, I don't know. But it does seem like a thing that like has been dialed back since like 9/11. But yeah, they still do guided tours. Have you ever looked into touring
your local 911 dispatch call center? Like, I haven't. Maybe they do offer them.
You know what, Jane? Let me look into it right now. Let me look into NYC 911 dispatch call center tours. Tours of NYC's actual 911 dispatch centers are generally not available to the public due to security, privacy, and the unpredictable critical nature of the work. But you can learn about the operations through their website.
Lame. I guess they don't have a Sue Blevins. But anyway, Sue Blevins' husband gets out of the store with his daffodils, and he and the security guard watch Sue run out of the car, seemingly to someone. Yeah. She says, like, stop, stop. And then a car just barrels into her and drives off.
Just fucking like hits the fuck out of her. She just gets, like, absolutely creamed by this car. It's ridiculous.
Yes, it's one of those things where she, like, goes, she, like, flips over the top of the car. It was a pretty bad hit. So, of course, the security guard and Jerry come over. She's got a pulse, but, you know, she's probably not in great shape. It's funny. Jerry comes over and says to her, you said you were going to stay in the car, which I just think is a funny thing to say to a lady who's passed out because she just got hit by a hit and run.
Yeah.
It's like, why didn't you do what you said you were going
to
do?
And so he instructs the woman when she calls 911 to always give the location first. And then she does.
Right.
And immediately we set up this this emergency crisis scenario where the side character, who we love but we haven't spent a lot of time with, like in her personal life, is put like in peril, put on death's door. It's really good. It's really interesting. Good use of your ensemble cast. And so the 118 responds, and they haven't been informed that it's Sue Blevins. They don't know that it's Sue Blevins. They just think it's some
lady.
They
have to realize when they see her and start treating her. It's Buck who recognizes her first, I think.
I assume they got to know each other because of the Abby connection. Or maybe the Maddie connection.
True.
And then Chimney recognizes.
Maybe he's the first to really know her. Right.
Chimney recognizes
Buck
her.
Buck says, it's Sue Blevins.
And then Chimney's like, it's Maddie's boss. And I'm like, yeah, that's who she is. And so it's immediately setting up this, not only this crisis scenario of she's got a subdural hematoma, she has cracked ribs, she might have a punctured lung, etc. It's very bad. Car accidents are very deadly. Or getting run over is
You're telling
deadly,
me this for the first
famously.
Time.
But also, they don't know, you know, who hit her because this guy who is driving the car did not stop. He didn't slow down at all. He just sped away. So it's not just a hit and run. It feels deliberate. So it sets up this mystery scenario. Who hit Sue Blevins? Oh,
and
classic.
Part of our mystery is that Sue, as they're wheeling her away, she starts to weakly say, 911, 911, which is a really funny thing for someone on this show who is the head of the 911 dispatchers to be saying. They think she's just like saying, they're like, yeah, girl, we called 911, we're here, it's fine. But obviously this has to mean something different, something else.
That's gonna be me.
Something I was noticing throughout this whole episode was the lack of the sparseness, the scarcity of Eddie in this episode.
I wasn't even mad about it.
I just thought it was funny because he had like three individual lines maybe in various scenes, and I like every time one would happen, I would be like, oh, an Eddie line.
So did you notice that the last two episodes of this season have also had very sparse, scattered use of Eddie Diaz? He's been background a lot, and it's reminiscent to me, like, of the other Ryan Murphy ensemble shows where some characters just get pushed to the side for, like, you know, episodes and arcs at a time.
Oh, yeah, Mike Chang.
Right. It's like, oh, Artie, you're here. Yeah, Blaine is right. he was giving, I don't know how this happened, but Eddie has been like relegated to like a background character for the last few episodes. And he's starting to feel like after the Glee project, when Damien McGinty and Samuel Larson won the Glee project and they were promised these sort of like beefy side character roles with like the promise of like graduating to like become main players in the show. Then they ended up being recurring cast only, and mostly just, you know, heads to populate various rooms, throwing in little quips and one-liners every now and again. Poor Samuel Larson.
So you're saying Eddie won the 911 project?
I'm saying Eddie is the Joseph Hart of 911.
Let's not forget, without spoiling anything, that Eddie has a rather large dramatic storyline at the end of this season. So maybe biding their time.
Oh God, Eddie's the, ooh, this is perfect actually, because this is karmic justice for Eddie. Eddie's the unique of 911. Eddie's the unique.
Wow.
It's funny. I just remembered what I was saying, that the Samuel Larson, who played Joe, the white guy with the dreadlocks on
yeah,
Glee.
Yeah, no, we all remember. We were all there.
He never got a solo. He never got a solo. Damien McGinty got 4. Lindsay Pierce got 2. Alex Newell got 2 in their first season when they were runner-up on the Glee
Project. I'm sorry. It's so funny that you know all of this information
I'm sorry. It occupies too much of my brain. My roommate last night was just making fun of me for it, because I was clowning on him for our D&D campaign taking up so much of his brain. And he's like, Ryan, you have absolutely no leg to stand on. And I'm like,
yeah,
yes.
How many pieces of vital information do you think your brain has just flushed down the toilet to make more room for like Glee cast facts, Glee
so much.
Cover facts?
So, I mean, so much. I forget birthdays all the time.
Anyway, in the show, yes, Buck thinks that what happened was an accident, but the security guard actually mentions to him, you know, that driver never took his foot off the gas. It kind of seemed deliberate, like you said. So that's our little, you know, title card. Mm-hmm. The mystery. Who, like you said, who killed Lila, right?
Who killed Lila? Who killed Lila Stangard? Who hit Sue Blevins? And who mm-hmm. sent Sunshine to the crack house? Leah Michelle was driving
Athena
the car.
Grant.
She couldn't read the road signs. Oh no! At Athena Grant,
we go to the Grant household, and Harry needs new shoes because he's growing so fast. And May takes this opportunity to pivot the conversation to a very kind of thought out, scripted sounding spiel about how her parents have done such a great job raising her and Harry, and now it's time for her to spread her wings and leave the nest because she wants to move out.
I love
it's so funny to me
Corinne's
that this is treated like
acting.
Such a controversial thing for her to bring up when she is like an adult who has graduated high school. But
it has
we know
a job.
How Athena is.
Yeah,
yeah,
we know how Athena
has a
is.
Job. A full-time job.
I love Corinne's acting in this scene because she delivers this very scripted-sounding monologue about how good of a job her parents did raising her and Harry to be their own independent people who are growing and, you know, evolving and are so responsible. And then at the end, she buttons it with just like this like closed-mouthed smile. And it's so canned, and like you're just like, mm-hmm. and it's so good. It sells the whole thing. And you immediately think, oh, Athena's gonna have something to say about this. Oh, Athena's not gonna be happy about this. But then it turns out the one who is actually not happy about this is Michael with his waffles.
Yes, Michael made waffles, and he is taken aback. But yeah, Athena, I like this because they're really continuing the storyline of the last episode where Athena is really making an effort to be less overbearing for May. And so she says, you know, like, well, you are an adult, and yeah, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Which, yeah, is a surprise to everyone.
I like this. I like this character growth moment for Athena. I really do. Because, like, it's weird to say, but, like, on a procedural show like this, it isn't often that you see, like, such, like, interpersonal, like, personality shifts towards, like,
yeah, some
more positive relationships, you know?
Yeah, and she's making an effort, which is like clear.
You usually get like a paltry like meeting halfway moment, which mm-hmm. usually means that nobody fundamentally changes, but at least they see each other's perspective. But like, yeah. it seems like she's actually doing like some work on herself, and that's good.
Yeah, Bobby comes in. Bobby comes in. The live studio audience cheers because it's yes. Bobby. And
hi, Bobby. Everybody say hi, Bobby.
Hi, Bobby.
Dead man
and
walking.
He's getting in from work. And they're like, what was something going on? You're late. And he says, well, I was just checking up with someone from a case last night, this hit and run. And the victim was Sue Blevins. And of course, Athena knows Sue Blevins. So she's like, oh, my, you know, juicy.
Just like that. She says, oh, my.
Oh, my. But we go straight to we don't really get to see her reaction in detail because mm-hmm. we go straight to the dispatch where Maddie and Josh are like crying in the break room. And Buck is there for some reason. Also
cavorting with Buck. Is like, just I had to get on this gossip session. You know, I couldn't miss
it. Right. Literally. They're all gossiping about what might have happened, speculating on what might have happened. And Josh mentions that he was talking to her on the phone mm-hmm. while she was waiting in the car, and then she just suddenly hung up. So they're all like, what could have happened? Mm-hmm. This is a big Josh episode.
Huge.
Maddie asks if he wants to go to the hospital to see Sue, and he's like, no, she'd want me here. The calls don't stop and we can't either. I'm the biggest boy after Sue and I need to be the boss now. And yeah, this is a big Josh episode where obviously he's one of the closest at the dispatch to Sue, so he's very affected by this. And I don't think Brian Safey does a bad job in this episode, but it is just classic Josh, like his hammy acting
yeah.
that I do think kind of makes a dramatic storyline like this a little yeah. harder to take seriously.
There are definitely a couple moments where yeah. he breaks out of the hamminess. There are definitely a couple moments where his performance mm-hmm. does feel genuinely grounded and good, but like overall, especially in like more of a like a crisis scenario like we find him in later, especially with his backstory, like you definitely like the ham comes out and it's like uh-huh. I listen Josh, I love you, but I need you to lock in, babe. Like we gotta sell this. And I appreciate that we're getting such a Josh episode. We're finally getting Josh Begins. Helmstever, there isn't a lot of crossover with our actual POV characters. And so there True. Is an element of this episode that, you know, while on the one hand I do appreciate, it does kind of make it feel like sort of a place out of time within the broader timeline of the show. Because like we're stepping away from most of our POV characters to focus on Josh, you know.
But we have a lot of Athena in this episode, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that's what keeps it on track. That and the Buck Taylor stuff, which, you know, I'm always happy about.
It's
not a huge problem, but that's kind of just like a little challenge of like centering so much on a side character in these ensemble shows.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But Buck mentions the thing of Sue kept saying 911. We're not sure what it means. And Josh is like so sad. He's mm-hmm. like, I don't know how this place is going to run without her. I've never had to have that before. And Maddie says, yeah, we all owe her a lot. And Josh says very dramatically, I owe her my life. You're like, okay, it's Josh backstory so, time.
It's so good. It's so funny to me. It's charming. And
we
also,
flashback?
Before yeah. we flashback, I have to ask a question, which is, did he immediately jump to, like, what if Sue dies? Because, like, I don't know how this place runs without her. She's not here all the time. Like, dispatch is always open, but
True.
Sue
like,
clocks in for 8-hour
shifts.
You know? Like,
you
what
know,
happens if she goes on
Sue
vacation?
Maybe Sue doesn't take a sick day. Maybe Sue is that amazing of a boss that she has literally come to work every day that she has been scheduled.
Well, then I'm surprised she hasn't been hospitalized sooner. You know, that's a lot to take on. She's been here since 1984. Yeah. Like, you know, this is not healthy, Sue. You need a work-life balance. What about Dawn? Doesn't Dawn get lonely?
I don't think she has a work-life balance because remember in the last episode where she said, like, my dispatchers are my kids. It's like, okay, it's fine to not have actual kids, but just like, do you have a life outside of the dispatch?
Yeah, it's like your kids can't be on the payroll, right? Like, that's...
Yeah, that's what I think.
Yeah,
but
anyways...
Yeah, we flashback all the way back to 2006, and you can tell it's 2006 because they do a sexy back needle drop.
Okay,
I don't know what that has to do with Josh, but he's walking up to... a job.
First of all, I will say he does look sexy in that suit. It's a very good look
for Brian. No, yeah, he is in a very
sharp very flattering suit. I will say, though, I hate Justin Timberlake. I hate him. I hate him so much. He gives me such an ick. I'm like, ugh, Justin Timberlake, no. And so when this needle drop happened, it just started crawling out of my skin. But yeah, Josh, he is bringing sexy back. That's true. And he does look sharp. The haircut's very nice. It's just a very flattering look for Josh. I was like, who's this man? Hello, sir, be my freelance stenographer.
Well, yes, Josh is walking up to a gig, essentially, at like an office building. And this lady's like, oh, you're the temp. And he's like, well, actually, I'm a freelance stenographer. And everybody's like, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. He's like, no, it's a thing, I promise. I have a website. And basically but he is practically a temp. They've hired him temporarily to like transcribe some meetings or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like a brand new office building where a new business is moving in because they're still unpacking everything.
They got him a chair.
Josh is very into, yes, he's very into ergonomic chairs, which fair enough. Mm-hmm. When you have a sedentary job, that is very important.
I feel like I should get one of those. I don't know how expensive those are, but I feel like that would be a good investment because I spend so much time at my computer.
Yeah. I mean, ergonomic just means, it's a very generic term. It just means like generally good for your back, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I do not have one of those.
So like any kind of gaming chair or office chair should be ergonomic.
I have a shitty rolling chair that has like very little in the way of like lower like sort of lumbar support. It's just basically just like a thin like sort of mesh back that's like kind of tightly woven. It's not good. I pad it with a little blanket.
I just got like kind of an office-y chair on Amazon when I moved, and it was maybe $80 or $90.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I got this one for free.
My cat loves it.
Your cat loves it. Boggy loves it.
She does.
Has she torn
Boggy
it up yet?
Boggy likes to sit in the chair. No, she's done pretty good. I do want to try trimming her nails for the first time today. Anyway, ergonomic chairs, they're great. And Josh starts transcribing. He's like got his formula down. Like he sits down with his giant like reusable mug of coffee. He even tells the lady like, it's okay if I have to work late, I'm a night owl. And he sits down and we kind of find out why he likes being a freelance stenographer. It's because he gets to listen to all the tea on these recordings, because it's like legal or something. It's like a law firm and they're gossiping about like, I don't like seeing that weird guy in the bathroom because I don't like his face and blah blah blah. First of all, Josh is so cringe because I didn't even mention
whoa,
earlier when he's talking
whoa,
to when
poor
he's
Josh.
No, sorry, when he's talking to the lady giving him the job, she's like, you know, we would transcribe these things in-house, but the partners or something, they get a little salty. Like she's implying that because there's kind of gossipy stuff on the recordings, they want to just hire a third party. And Josh says, oh, I don't mind salt, but I usually prefer it with a lime and a good tequila. And you're like, okay, Josh.
It is cringe. Like, okay. I will say, though, the writing of that moment was also cringe because I don't know that salty was in vogue in 2006. I don't think it was. I don't think people were saying that until the 2010s.
Yeah, I'm not sure, really. It could have been, like, sometimes these slang words technically exist for a long time, but then only pick up steam at a certain point.
So Josh was ahead of the curve. He was like the cool older millennial.
And that's
millennial.
Why everybody thought him cringe. He was actually, it was the employer who said salty first.
Yeah. I don't think Josh is even a millennial. I think he's Gen X. I think he's he's like young Gen
now
X.
Now that we know how old he is,
yeah.
We didn't before.
I'm pretty sure
he
he's young
be a millennial.
Gen X.
The oldest millennials are pretty old.
How old? Say it for our listeners.
Like mid-40s. Not that that's old. I'm just saying like they're not like 20-somethings anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Ponder your mortality, millennial listeners. We all must at some point.
I have been pondering my mortality, you know, and I'm 25. You're 25 now. You know, we're all, you know, on death's door. We'll probably never experience being in a band. And that's something we have to
unless
live with. Unless
we start the first Respodcast band right now.
Yes, first band Spodcast.
Yes.
Yes. Now I feel like that would be the thing that I don't know. I just feel like that would be like a slippery slope to us getting canceled for some crazy shit. I don't know why.
Because bands are always getting canceled.
Yeah.
That's true.
That's true. So Josh is, he's stenographing. He's stenographing. He's transcribing this interaction between this man and this woman who are business professionals, presumably. And he said, this guy, I just don't like the cut of his jib, you know? He's just got this face that I want to punch. He's got a very punchable face. There's a German word for it, but I don't know what it is. And Josh, like a loser, says to himself, I don't know how to pronounce it. I have the subtitle pulled up, and I'm looking at the word.
Yeah, but he knows the German word.
Backpfeifengeschicht? Backpfeifengeschicht? I don't speak German.
I don't think it really matters.
Sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Josh is the one who knows how to say it.
When
I was looking for a job like last year, I actually looked into what it takes to become a stenographer because I was like, well, I like typing fast. I could not be a stenographer. They actually,
it's fucking
hard.
They
don't just type fast. They have to type like an insane amount of words per minute, and they have to have like stenographer shorthand, and you have to buy your own stenographer machine, and they're expensive. Yeah. And a lot of places require you to like go to school. Like you have to go to like a technical college or community college to be a stenographer.
Yeah.
And once I got to that point, I was like, this sounds like too much work.
You fully cannot
but I was looking into it
because
there were actually a lot of
this.
Steno openings at like local city and government jobs.
You actually cannot make mistakes if you're a stenographer too, especially if you're like you're the court, like a stenographer for like a like court proceedings, like a trial. Like you can't make mistakes, and you also like, I mean, you have to be on your game for hours, because if a lawyer or the judge is like stenographer, read back that, you know, what happened half an hour ago, and you're like, sorry, I was yawning. I'm a little tie-tie today. Like, that's not going to fly. You're going to get fired. You could cause a mistrial. Don't do it. So, yeah, I could also never... joining the list of jobs we could never do, talking about on this show, stenographer.
Right, stenographer. Well, maybe that's why Josh is a freelance stenographer. Maybe he didn't want to do all the qualifications. So, like, maybe he's not qualified to work in a court, but he's like, he just does this.
Yeah. But he is living for the gossip, the drama, everything. Like, he is, he loves his job. Because he just loves just like, I don't know, knowing everything about everyone all the time. Maybe
but
that's part of the joy of being a dispatcher for him.
This backfires because he is so absorbed in the gossip, the goss sesh, that he looks up at one point and realizes, oh, it's nighttime. Mm-hmm. And he takes off his headphones and, oh, the fire alarm is going off. And also, no one else is here. I'm alone.
And all the lights
this
are
evil
off.
This evil workplace.
It's
this
so evil.
This evil workplace. I get that they were, like, still settling in, so maybe they forgot. But, like, nobody went into, like, checked this office to be like, hey, the building's on fire. You need to evacuate.
His fucking face when he sees the lights go off and everything and he takes off his headphones is so funny to me. That's like a good moment of like face acting from Brian. I love you so much. I'm sorry I call you Hammy. I love you, Brian.
We should clip that and make it into a reaction gif. That could go far
yes.
on Stan Twitter.
No, please. I that would go triple platinum on my account. So yes, he is trapped in this darkened, unfamiliar, burning building. He's trapped. He's stuck. Even he gets stuck a little later, but for now he's trapped. And he calls 911. And who should answer the phone?
Who should answer the phone?
But that wig. This wig is insane.
It's crazy. Okay, this whole part of the episode confuses me because am I wrong or is young Sue Blevins played by a different actress?
No, it's
right?
still her.
Isn't Wait, what?
Still, isn't it still her? Is it not still? I'm looking
oh
at her.
God.
I'm pulling up her face. Is that not her?
No, yeah, I'm looking
fully
at
her.
The cast. Oh my God, I got wig tricked. I got wig winked because this, I have always thought that this is just a different actress. And I've always thought like, well, that seems unfair. Why did young Sue get a different actress, but Josh didn't?
You
guys,
into
I am
the fantasy
actually flabbergasted.
Of the wig.
I bought
you
into
bought
the fantasy.
Into
the
it.
Wig worked on me. Although maybe it didn't work on me because we are supposed to buy that it's the same person. But yes, the important
I just love
part
it.
Is
the wig
they
is
do
so
like
uncanny
an Avengers...
that it did this. Yes, they do an Avengers
they do
reveal.
Like an Avengers style reveal where she sort of turns to the camera and goes, "I'm Sue Blevins," and you're like, "Yeah, fuck yeah!"
Everybody claps, everybody cheers. It's amazing. It yes. genuinely is amazing. So I love it when they do these like Avengers ass style shots in these yeah. shows, just for completely
but
mundane characters.
But not in the Lone
characters.
Star crossover episode.
But not in the Lone Star crossover
flirting versus
episode.
Harassment.
You know, Sue Blevins will always be the flirt. Sue Blevins will always be like sort of the yes. consensual, like, you know. So we then cut back to the present. And we're in the suburbs where Athena lives. And we know it's the suburbs because it's a suburban neighborhood with LA in the far distance across the mountains. I did not realize that Athena lives so far away from the city.
Yeah.
I guess I just
Maybe
didn't
it's
think about
she's
it.
Maybe it's because she's so overprotective of her kids.
Yeah, yeah. But Athena, she is on the phone with Michael talking about the whole May thing. Michael is... not taking it very well. He is like, we need yeah. to put up a united front. She needs to stay our little girl. She needs to stay at home.
Which, again,
it's dangerous.
She is a grown-up with a full-time job who has graduated high school.
She can't go into the woods. She'll get attacked by wolves, you know? And Bobby's over here like, so what's going on? Would you like some more tea? And she's like, don't mind if I do. And they start gossiping. They start gossiping. Athena.
And, you know, Bobby kind of thought of, like everybody else, that Athena would be the one to have the reaction to this.
Mm-hmm.
But Athena's like, yeah, you know, I'm working on it. And I keep thinking about the argument that me and May had in the last episode. Because I feel like I'm becoming my mother, essentially. She's thinking about her own relationship with her mom and how mm-hmm. they always clashed and realizing, like, I sounded like her and I don't want my relationship with my daughter to be like that. Again, good continuation from the last episode. Mm-hmm. Good, genuine character development for Athena.
Good storytelling. Good. Oh my God, good storytelling. And Bobby is very, like, assuring. He says, you know, you're not your mother. You have a very different relationship with May. And Athena, she doesn't want to, we get expanded on this later on in a different scene, but she doesn't want to be that voice that makes May self-doubt, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so we leave it on this note of like, Athena's doing a lot of introspection and thinking about her relationship right. and reevaluating now that May's an adult. And then we go to... Buck
Elsewhere,
Taylor.
Buck and Taylor are on
lunch.
Like a shitty little food truck date. And I love this for them.
I love this so much.
I love
so
this
much.
For them. I love Baylor. I love Tuck.
I love Tuck. Hashtag Tuck writes.
I love Tuck.
You know.
I'm into it. I'm into it this season. Maybe it's because I've like been through so much with Eddie and Buddy this year, but like the way you and Justin were jumping ship to Buck Robbie, now I'm like, you know what, maybe Taylor should be Buck Endgame.
Yes,
because I was just
Taylor
enjoying
Endgame.
Their scenes together. She's like a better actress than Ryan Guzman.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. she's selling it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I also love this scene because all it is an excuse to make Buck a mouthpiece for 911 dispatcher
yes.
propaganda, which I think is so iconic. He just starts like spouting. He tells Taylor about what happened to Sue and how she's been at dispatch for so long. He's like spouting all these facts, like the dispatch center here in LA didn't open until 1984. And did you know that dispatchers aren't even classed as first responders mm-hmm. in many parts of the country? And it's like, okay,
it only
on
changed
one of
in California last year. And it's like, you care so much about this. You're so passionate. I'm so charmed by this, Buck. I love you. You're so, you have such a big open heart. And Taylor Kelly, she's there like, let me be on my phone at lunch. And Buck's like, Sue was hit
by
a car.
That is funny that they have. Yeah. So he's like, I know what'll get her off her phone. By the way, that lady I was just talking about, she got hit by a fucking car.
Yeah.
And Taylor's like, that's awful. And she realizes, you're probably not just telling me about this because you, whatever, you want to spout random facts to me. And Buck reveals, you know, the police don't have any leads, but maybe someone out there does. If it were to, I don't know, be on the news.
I don't know how well Taylor knows Buck, but I would never assume that about Buck because he loves sitting someone down and spouting
spout
random facts at them. He is so baby girl. Now, Taylor, she sort of keys in on his angle here. And she's like, you know, less than 10% of hit and runs get resolved. It's a whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, this could turn out just like that. And he's like, unless it got on the news. She's like, I can't go to my story editor with just a hit and run because that happens all the time. So tell me more about this dispatch center. And Buck's like,
right,
I got you, babe. And then a scheme was formed.
It'd be funny if they just did the exact same thing that they did in Dosed, where she just shows up to dispatch being all annoying, like, hey, I'm filming a feature here. Carry on.
And everyone's like, literally just, not the time.
Your boss was just in a terrible car accident.
Yeah. Our boss is not... our boss is on death's door and you want to film us. And then you just see, like, a moment of, like, Jamal, like, saying... Like doing, like, sort of the hen thing where he's, like, when I was 16, these 911 dispatchers saved my life. And then you get that shot of him, like, sort of looking down from the side, like, introspectively.
The drama editing.
Yes. The drama editing over Jamal. That's not...
But we do get some Jamal in this episode. Because mm-hmm. Back at the dispatch... Taylor is not annoying everybody filming her feature, but Josh has stepped up.
Josh is annoying Jan by being hammy.
He's the boss who stepped up because he is giving everybody the little talk about, you know, here's how Sue is doing, and I know this is tough, and he's kind of looking to Maddie for what to say next, mm-hmm. and she reminds him, like, you should tell them if they need to talk to anybody, and he's like, oh yeah, we'll have counselors around if you need to... If you're really sad about your boss getting,
getting destroyed
by a car.
Speaking of Ryan Murphy style ensemble background characters, Maddie mm-hmm. has had nothing to do this entire episode. And Sue is the person confided in this entire time. Like, why aren't we getting more Maddie with this? Maybe it's because Jennifer LaHewitt was pregnant and they were like the maternity clothes. Maybe. I have to hide her body a little bit. I don't know. Just for continuity's sake.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I can see why they would focus on Josh because like he has known Sue longer, whatever. He's like the boss underling or whatever. But yeah, it does feel odd that we don't get much Maddie perspective in this episode.
I mean, we care about Maddie. You know what I mean? We love Maddie. And I'm not saying we don't love Josh, but we love Maddie. I certainly do. So I was definitely missing some more Maddie drama, although mm-hmm. the last shot of this episode did not let me down. And that's all I'll say for now.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll have words about that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Josh tells everybody that if they need to talk, the counselors are available and he's available if they need anything. Imagine being like, yeah, Josh, I want to talk to you about how sad I don't know why I'm roasting him so hard. He's fine.
I would confide in Josh. Wouldn't you confide in Josh?
There's nothing wrong. But he walks off and I believe he starts reminiscing again. Or wait.
No, he does. He's having PTSD.
Yes. Josh walks off and he starts reminiscing again about his first meeting with Sue.
Reminiscing is a very flowery way of putting it. It's very...
Yeah, that's the second time I've
also,
done that.
I don't know how else he would say it. I don't know how else he would say it because, like, you know, he's not having, like, PTSD trauma flashbacks. Or maybe he is. I don't know. I don't know his life. Yeah. Maybe
and
he's
in
therapy
the flashbacks,
for this.
In the flashbacks, Josh is being a bit of an obtuse, annoying mansplainer because Sue Blevins, the expert here, is like, you've got to go up to get away from the smoke. And Josh is like, that sounds like a stupid idea. I think I should go down. And Sue is literally like, no, listen to me. I'm the person who's supposed to get you out of this situation. And Josh
is
like going into smokier and smokier.
It was 2006.
Oh, so he just inherently respected women less back then.
Woke hadn't happened yet. Like, I'm sorry.
I was actually gonna say earlier, like when we first flashed back to 2006, I was thinking, do we think Josh was maybe like not out of the closet yet because Glee hadn't aired yet?
Do you think he was a pre-Glee gay or a post-Glee gay? That's the question.
Well, given his speech in season 8, it kind of seems like he was like projecting in that scene. It kind of seems like he owes his entire like blossoming as a gay person to Glee based on the way he talked about it. I'm just going to say, I think he was technically a pre-Glee gay, but like he was a Glee gay period. Like, yeah. I think Glee is what gave him the courage to be true to himself.
I want to sit Chris Colfert down on a couch and show him that season 8 episode and just watch as he sort of comes to terms with his legacy on this earth. I just think it would be very amusing. Chris Colfert, come on the pod, please.
We would love to have you.
We'll play all of your hits, you know, Defying Gravity, Kurt's version. We'll play Rose's Turn.
I don't think that is would attract him to be on the pod.
We'll play Being Alive. Oh, you know what? I loved it in season 5 when he did I'm Still Here. So we'll play that as well. That'll be his intro for the show.
Once again, the useful information is just dripping out of Ryan's ears right now while he makes room for all of the Glee facts, all of the Glee covers. In the present, Josh is now being a dispatcher. Josh is on the phone with a caller who's this guy who is being kind of confronted by this woman. He's in his car.
He's and being held at him with baseball bat point. Yeah, it's very intense on the streets of L.A. Who should be on the scene but Athena Grant? This woman is yelling, "Where is my child? I know you have her. My daughter's missing." Mm. And then he's like, "Leave me alone. I'm just in my car. I haven't seen her in over a month." And Athena's like, "What is going on? Have you hit that car yet?" "Yeah." "No, you haven't. But if you do, I'll take you into the station myself." She's, you know, clearly not doing well. He is pushing for her to get arrested because apparently she's been holding him at bat point for a half an hour. He couldn't have just driven away, ? I feel like it wouldn't have been that hard.
That's a great question.
It's not a gun, right?
But Athena decides to ask her about this whole situation. She's like, "Tell me about your daughter." She says she's been missing for a couple days. Nobody's heard from her. And we went to the police, but they didn't even seem like they really cared. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to hold my breath. Mm-hmm. And
she's 21, by the way. The daughter's 21.
And she suspects this guy because he's like the most recent boyfriend of the girl. And she recently broke things off. And she thinks that he's not a guy who likes to be told no.
Yeah.
So Athena goes over, taps on his window with the baseball bat, and asks him to give his side of the story. But he claims at least not to know. He says he hasn't talked to her in weeks. And he's got an alibi, whatever.
A solid alibi. He was moving into his mom's basement, so he seems like kind of a loser. And apparently a million people saw him while he was doing it, because I guess he had friends to help him out with it.
Everybody probably came and pointed and laughed at him as he was moving back into his mom's basement.
I certainly would have. I mean, this guy seems like a bit of a loser, to be honest. And so Athena, she gets inspired, so she looks into the case. And and the mom's description is accurate. You know, she filed the police report and the detective assigned to the case just sat on it and said, "Well, she's 21. She'll probably just come home. She probably just like needed a break or whatever," and is very much not taking this seriously. And so Athena decides to take on the case herself because, you know, there's a very clear dynamic here where this woman who's 21 is black and this police officer is presumably white or is just, you know, doing as cops do and not taking the needs of black women seriously. This other detective guy comes in. I don't remember his name. What's this guy's name?
I never remember his name. Let's just call him
McFarty. He seems like a McFarty to me.
McFarty. Let's call him McFarty.
Detective McFarty comes in. Yeah.
This episode is kind of making a commentary about some people refer to it as like the less dead. There's a phenomenon where particularly women of color, and in particular like black women and indigenous women, when they go missing, tend to be the least cared for by authorities. There are a lot of famous examples of like serial killers who were able to continue killing for a long, long time because maybe their victims were like sex workers of color and stuff. And police departments did not really feel an urgent need to investigate such crimes. A lot of cases of famous serial killers, you have like people talk about them like, "Oh, they were just such a mastermind that they never got caught." And it's like, if you look into it, it's often actually like the local police department got a million tips about it and never did anything. That's something they're exploring in this episode, is this phenomenon of like a black woman not being a high priority for police in the way that a young white woman disappearing might be.
Yeah, this is a problem all over North America. I mean, like, you know, it's a huge problem in the US and also in Canada. Like, there's a... So I grew up in Seattle, mm-hmm. right? And in British Columbia, there's a highway known
You're
as...
You're telling me this for the first time.
The Highway of Tears. the Seattle part or the Highway of Tears part?
No, this... I'm sorry. I was making fun of you for bringing up being from Seattle again.
So in British Columbia, in Canada, there's a highway known as the Highway of Tears, right? Where a lot of Indigenous women go missing and end mm-hmm. up kidnapped and murdered along the highway, whether they're hitchhiking, whether they're, you know, whatever, kidnapped in some way. And it's a huge problem. And the police in British Columbia have done, you know, just an absolute bang up job investigating it and, getting to the heart of this problem. He said facetiously, it's, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's a huge problem all over. So I really appreciated seeing it covered on this show, and they do, I will say they do like a pretty good job of it. I mean, it's not like a systemic critique of like the police.
That's the thing. You know? That's the thing, is I appreciate them trying, but you cannot talk about this stuff without a systemic critique. So
exactly.
When you see, like, later on, a scene between Hen and Athena being like, man, this always happens, and then no inner examination of, like, so Athena... Mm-hmm. A, why do you still work for them? /B, like, are you going to try and do anything about this wider yeah. problem? Like, apparently not. It's nice that she happened to hear about this case and take it under her wing. But, like, how many other countless cases is this kind of thing happening with that she will not know about
yeah.
and will not get solved because this is a systemic problem that no one is making any effort to solve? It's yeah. just, yeah, that
it's
was
really...
taking me back to Athena Begins. And
yeah.
Rage.
It's a really big issue to bring up as like a one-off storyline, right? And so
yeah.
Because of that, the execution can feel very hollow. I will say, like, looking at it as like a one-off storyline, like, it's not the most egregious example of this sort of thing on the show. And I appreciated that it was,
a
marked improvement from past efforts. Mm-hmm. But still, it did fall short in that regard. That scene ends basically with Athena and Detective McFarty over
McFarty.
Here taking on the case. And then we go to, woman at work, because Taylor Kelly is on the news about Sue Blevins getting struck down in the parking lot of the organic grocery store. And May and Jamal
yes.
and Linda are watching with tears in their eyes. And finally, mm-hmm. it's going to get solved because it's actually getting attention. And that's good. And so then at the hospital, Josh runs into Don because Sue is crashing. She's crashing hard.
She's
they have
coding.
To take her to emergency surgery. She's coding, guys. She's coding. She's bleeding internally. It's a whole thing. And so they rush her into emergency surgery and they're just like, Oh my God. This is so
yeah,
awful.
Josh is like supporting Sue's husband. Mm-hmm. It's not funny, but you know. And then we go back to our flashback.
I never LOL'd harder, you know, at this show. Like, this show, this is a sitcom, guys. Like,
we go back to our flashback. Sue is still telling Josh to go up. And he finds someone in the stairwell. He finds an unconscious woman, and Sue coaches him through, like, getting into a position where he can put her on her back and carry her upstairs.
Pre-Glee, pre-woke Josh stumbles his way into becoming a hero. It's very funny
Literally.
To me. And so, yeah, he you know, fireman carries her up the stairs using all of the strength mm-hmm. in his legs. I don't know what kind, like, if Josh goes to the gym, I have to assume he's like an elliptical gay. I feel like he loves the elliptical
machine. Maybe he
started
after this.
Maybe. I can totally see him being like a cardio and yoga gay. But he gets her up the stairs to the 36th floor to this unfinished room because this mm-hmm. company is new and the building is still like being renovated. He sees out the window. She's at the window. The 118 responds. And we get
homophobic Sue Gerard is like, I'll stay on the line. I'll stay on the line until help arrives. And the 118, Josh kind of passes out like from exhaustion. Mm-hmm. He passes out. And what does he see when he opens his eyes? The big scary face of Captain Gerard. Do you think Gerard was probably heartbroken that he had to save a gay?
That's
what I wrote in my notes.
I before Gerard even showed up, I just wrote down in my notes, no, Gerard was there being homophobic. And then when he showed up and we got the jump scare, I just wrote down, yep.
It's almost kind of an elephant in the room. Address me. It's almost kind of an elephant in the room that, like, Gerard is there and he's in a couple shots and he just, like, doesn't do anything mean and Gerard-like. It feels like a precursor to the Gerard whitewashing, the Gerard rehabilitation of 2024 or whatever, where it's just odd because, you know, the last time we saw Gerard on this show, it was always like being a huge asshole. So wouldn't it have been funny if they just to keep his characterization consistent, just had him randomly like say something homophobic to John?
It's like,
or like even worse, he like looks at his file or whatever and he's like, Russo, is that a Latin name?
it's like the dark inverse of that thing that they said at the beginning of the show, like, we don't get to choose who we save. And it's like that quote, but then in parentheses, bigoted. we have fun. And Chimney's there because Chimney is on the squad at this point. Thankfully, we do not get a Tommy Kennard cameo. We don't even get a Sal cameo.
I really thought it might be coming.
I thought it might be coming too, but no, he doesn't come back until...
I guess they're off shift exploring each other's bodies right now.
They're on a vacation day at Boca or wherever, wherever they go. Maybe Sal took him home to meet his family in Sicily. And then back in the present, so Josh is talking to Maddie at Maddie's apartment and is just saying, Sue's going into surgery and she could die. Will you please... please make me tea. And she's like, I got you, babe. And she does. And he's like, I can't go home. She's like, you probably should go home. He's like, I can't. She's like, I don't want you in my house because I'm a new mom.
That's not what she says. That's not what she says. But he's talking about how he has to work tomorrow. And she says, maybe you should stay home, not maybe you should go home.
I was just starting
But
shit.
Josh is like, no, like, I've got to do my duty. You know,
duty
it's like
poop.
Sue always says, no, it's like Sue always says, you know, the world, we just, the best thing we can do for our loved ones out there is to do our jobs. And, you know, I got that from her. I got all my best stuff from her. I'm really scared. I don't know what's going to happen if she dies. And Maddie's like, I'm scared too. Not that the show's going to explore how I feel about this. But Maddie's like, we've got to have the faith in her that she would have in all of us. You know, she's going to pull through.
His nose is so red in this scene because presumably he's been crying and blowing snot through it.
It is quite red.
And so I wrote down in my notes, Russo the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I just wanted to share that.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays, guys. This year, 2025, they gave us the gift of the death of movies. So yay, the film industry is dying. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Okay, well, we also, yes, but we also have Russo the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Don't forget about that. Everybody put a little gay Eddie at the top of your tree this year.
Yay.
And maybe it'll come true. but at the...
wake up, wake up on Christmas Day, and then under the tree is just like gay Ryan Guzman jump scare. Ass
I love
out.
That it's not just gay Eddie to you, it's gay Ryan Guzman jump scare.
I just I feel like one begets the other. No, I'm just kidding. That is the straightest man to ever live, and that's why gay Eddie needs to happen so he can learn a life lesson. Thank you. Yeah, so Josh is scared, and like, we get it, you know.
Josh
he's
is scared.
His face isn't giving, but it's fine. And
at the Grant household, Hen and Athena are queening out together. They're having a little white wine moment.
White wine moment.
And they're like we said, they're talking about this double standard of how Black women are overlooked when it comes to these missing person cases, etc. And Hen does this thing about, you know, cops used to do outreach in my neighborhood, and I always wondered why they didn't do that in Beverly Hills. You know, it's like, why do the cops need to know us to be able to serve us, but not with other communities, which is all very true. And again, you're like, so Athena, should we unpack this?
So that's the frustration with this, because that is genuinely a really poignant moment, and in isolation this is a quite poignant scene, but then like it's like, so we're just not going to examine this any further? We're not going to broaden the scope a little bit? Because, like, they're talking about this as if it's a bug and not a feature. Like, this is how the, you know, institution of the police has acted since its inception, since before its inception.
Or it's just this deep discomfort that you always get with these moments, because it's like they'll outline a very clear and very real systemic issue and then just kind of move on without any, like, acknowledgement of the fact that Athena's a cop. There's not going to be any systemic change. She doesn't even really seem interested in systemic change.
We know that at the end of the day, they have to pledge fealty to the police and they have to keep doing this and everything. And it's very frustrating. So, like, my justification for this was just like, you know, not like overlooking that, but I guess accepting it and, you know, trying to take the good parts about this scene for what they were. Because there are good parts
but
about this
presumably the show realizes that this is getting awkward, because they pivot the conversation.
Yes, they do.
Hen is like, does that remind you of that missing persons case from when you were little? And Athena says, actually, no, it's reminding me of my little girl and how she wants to move out. And Hen also
Segways
is like,
are
oh,
a literary
you must
device.
Have shut that down. You must have shut that down real quick. And Athena's like, why does everybody think I'm such a hard ass? Don't answer that. And she's
it's
like,
so
no,
good.
Like, I was okay with it. I was okay with it. But, you know, she does worry about letting her daughter out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
Hen took that personally. You know, Hen...
Well, Hen commiserates because she's thinking about Nia again. Yeah. And she's like, it wasn't just scary to me to think of her leaving me, but specifically the fear that she might go back into a bad situation and I wouldn't be there to protect her, which presumably is what Athena is feeling about May moving out.
Mm-hmm. What Athena needs to do, what Michael needs to do, because Athena's Hen in this situation, what Michael needs to do is hire a private investigator and look up that landlord's ass with a flashlight.
Right.
That's what needs to happen in order for them to be okay with this, if we learned anything from
probably
the Nia story.
Probably not a bad idea, honestly.
Honestly, not a bad idea. I mean, like, I just moved into my apartment and it, like, a month ago, and it's great, but, like, we still haven't gotten our laundry cards, so we're all psyching ourselves up to like make like the half a block walk to the laundromat down the street, which is like it's not hard, but it's just like one of those things where it's just like it's so mildly inconvenient that we're just like, who's gonna do it first? So I've instead of washing my clothes, I've just been buying more clothes.
Oh my god, you can't live like that.
And anyhow, we're gonna get them any
Athena
day now
says,
the laundry cards
Athena
apparently
says that she doesn't want to be that voice in May's head that makes her doubt herself. Mm-hmm. And Hen's like, then don't be the voice that teaches her how to protect herself and when the world doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nice, I guess.
That's nice. So they spit facts at each other for a while, and then Athena and Detective McFarty go to the car show to watch Taylor Kelly on the news. My favorite activity.
Right.
My favorite activity. So there's this like car dealership where the woman in question who's disappeared works in the sales. No, not sales. She works in the service department, right? The guy who runs it is like a subtle chauvinist. He calls them the girls, the people who work in in the service department, because it's all women, and he's like, the girls go home
at
6:15.
It's like the perfume counter in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Just that's where all the pretty girls in town work.
Yeah. And so they start doing some sleuthing with this woman who's working the service counter named Meredith. Meredith. Now, I can't take this name seriously, and it's all because of Teen Wolf. It's all Teen Wolf's fault.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Grey's Anatomy.
No, I'm thinking of the
Meredith from Teen Wolf.
The benefactor, if you will.
Benefactor spoilers.
The spoilers. Meredith Grey as well, I suppose. But honestly, I would take that seriously. I'd be like, oh my god, a professional is in charge. So basically, Meredith gives them the spiel that she told the mom, she needed to go to the bathroom, so I left, and that was the last time I saw her. And they're like, now tell us everything you didn't tell the mom. She's like, oh.
Right.
Then shows.
Turns out Tracy, this table. Missing girl, was a big gambler, and she liked to hustle guys at cards by, playing the innocent young woman act and then beating their asses at poker. And when Athena and McFarty look at the security footage, it's funny to us. They look at the security footage and they see that she was with a guy that night, and this guy, something seemed a little off about him. She's acting drunk when she leaves, even though she wasn't served any alcohol. So they roll back the tape and they see that he put something in her drink. Scary.
Very scary.
And then they look at the parking garage footage and they see that this guy, put her into his car and then drove away. He had something obscuring his license plate on purpose because he's a kidnapper. But what should the car be but a red Galaxy?
Ooh.
And guess what car hit Sue Blevins? A red Galaxy. It's all connected. Her web connects them all.
There are no B plots. It all feeds back into the A plot. Ooh, it's good television writing. I know that they went with the drugging and kidnapping storyline. And I know why they did that, because it's very realistic, unfortunately. I thought that they were going to go a more insane route and have it be like a thing of like she got like the shit beat out of her for counting cards and it was like a poker game scandal or something.
Well, it does seem kind of random that they went with the poker thing.
Yeah, you'd like think it would be related,
right? We hear later that he's like a serial kidnapper, so it's not that he like kidnapped her as revenge for beating him at poker.
Is he the poker fiend? Does he always choose women at like a poker game? Yeah, they could have been at a bar. She should have been at the club. But it's weird that it's poker and like it's not like something like gambling related, right? Like she like extorted a bunch of money from this establishment and now they're holding her for ransom. I mean, I know that's the more sensationalized version of it and they went for something more grounded. On my favorite grounded, realistic and gritty TV show, 911 on Fox and later ABC, starring the great Angela Bassett and the late great Bobby Nash. I was confused by the need for a poker scene, but I guess poker's fun. It's whatever. It's personal. It adds personality, adds flavor. Yeah. It's fine. Her web connects them all.
And Athena kind of jumps to the conclusion correctly that I think Sue Blevins saw our kidnapper.
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, amateur sleuths Buck and Taylor are coming to the same conclusion. Because Buck rolls up in his Jeep to the parking lot to meet Taylor.
Imagine if Buck also drove like a red Galaxy. Could you imagine?
Buck
hit Sue. Oh no.
But Taylor has noticed something odd on the security footage. She's like not sure if Buck should see it because she's like, well, you know this lady. Do you really want to see the video of her getting destroyed by a car? But he watches. And they both notice that he really didn't slow down. They're like, "What? We can't figure out why she's running towards the car." And Buck also jumps to the conclusion of maybe she saw something she wasn't supposed to. She saw something in his car or near his car. So they're like, what could it have been? They look over, they see there were these dumpsters. And they're jumping to a lot of conclusions here. But again, because they're on a TV show, they will turn out to be right.
Well, it's Taylor Kelly. She's an investigative reporter,
True. Supposedly, they actually call out the There Goes the Neighborhood episode.
Yes, they do.
Buck says, I heard about this case a few months ago where some guy was running an illegal plastic surgery clinic out of his apartment and he was hiding all the evidence in dumpsters. So he's like, maybe there's something in those dumpsters. They start walking over and who should roll up but Athena Grant and McFarty. because at this point it's starting to feel like Athena maybe has a tracker on Buck. Like, do you think she put an air tag in his car? Maybe after he tried to solve the Maddie thing on his own, she was like, I'm keeping an eye on this.
I feel like it had to be even stupider than that. Maybe she gave him like a pop socket as like a random gift, and that had and like an air tag in it.
Well, it's like, he's Buck. He wouldn't think to be skeptical of anything. He would have been like, wow, Athena's so nice for giving me a gift.
Yeah. And then it's like, oh, right. Oliver Stark's, like, his I got caught face is so funny, too. I mean, he never looks more British than he does when he looks pissed off and slowly turns around.
Yeah.
And what's weird is
Athena actually like takes their asses to the station.
Yes.
They've got them both in separate interrogation rooms. Holding room. Buck is like checking his teeth in the two-way mirror.
And McFarty's like, okay. Watching like disgusted. Like,
McFarty's watching.
This guy.
It's like, don't judge. You know, your name is McFarty.
Literally. So literally. Really, you know, literally. Your parents hated you. I mean, they hated this guy too, but you know, they hated you
that
more.
That is your real name. So Athena found in the dumpster a handbag and ID belonging to the missing girl. And it's funny, she's just like fully, at this point, she's not even chastising Buck. She's just like sharing all the details of the case with him.
Well, first of all, he didn't do anything wrong. He just led her to the conclusion that she was also drawing. She just caught him before he could do something stupid and disturb evidence. And so
they conclude that this girl was kidnapped less than a mile away from the store, and that Sue must have seen her, and that would explain why he was gunning for her like that. And then they jump to another conclusion. This is maybe the most ridiculous one.
This is the most ridiculous one in the entire
Buck
show.
Buck is remembering that she was saying 911, and he's like, what if she wasn't saying 911? What if she was saying 911? And I almost thought this was going to be a comedy beat because it was so stupid. But no, they're Athena takes them seriously. And they're like, okay, 91W. Maybe she was trying to spell out the license plate, which would have to be a vanity plate. Because like, I guess Athena's saying they don't usually start with that kind of number.
Well, they normally don't start with three numerical digits. So the 911 makes more sense as like a genuine, authentic license plate. We have that like partial plate established. Meanwhile, McFarty walks into the other interrogation room. Taylor Kelly is on her phone, sipping on a coffee, and without looking up, she says, "Station lawyers are already on the way." And he's like,
where
"Maybe
did
you should
get
send
the coffee?
A camera crew."
Did they bring her a coffee?
She's powerful.
Because she's just that.
She's powerful. Yeah. She's Jennifer Lopez
she's
in
do you
Hustlers.
Know
like,
who
let
I
her
am?
Have her phone? You know, like this woman knows how to get what she wants, and is so comfortable in any situation. I have no choice but to stand. She's skinny.
No, literally. But they discover, they do find a corresponding license plate, and so they put out kind of an Amber Alert saying, you know, Red Vero Galaxy license plate, blah, 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 911, whatever. And everybody at the 118 sees the alert. At the dispatch, they see the alert.
They have road signs up with it. I love like how much of like the world of the show we're seeing with this Amber Alert going out. It was actually really well done. I was getting like really invested in it. And this is what I'm saying. When you make good active use of like your setting, it makes the world feel big,
right.
And it makes the stakes of the situation feel all the more all the higher, you know. So it was really well done. It was good. It was good directing. Good,
it's true.
Good on Tasha Smith.
And you also see an interesting kind of environmental detail of now at dispatch, since this alert went out, they're getting a bunch of like kind of, you know, fake calls where people think they've seen the car. You see Jamal answering the phone like, no, the car wasn't a minivan, but thanks for calling. which I imagine this kind of thing happens if you put out a big Amber Alert, everybody's on the lookout. But finally, they get a real call from somebody saying, I'm pretty sure I just saw the car parked by this fence near a container yard. Ooh, so we've got our third act exciting set piece. It's a like shipping container yard.
This is fun because it's like it's a cool little it creates a little like a cat and mouse game within like the world mm-hmm. that feels very natural. You get this moment of like they find the blood and they realize that this is, you know, this is the final location. And so Josh, I just rewatched Star Wars and I could not stop thinking about when Josh is calling in all the backup. It was like a red leader standing by, red two standing by, red five standing by. And like you see all the different cop like rolling up, like a one guy's on his motorcycle, there's like different cars, squad cars, mm-hmm. etc. Rolling up to the scene, and they go into the maze of shipping containers. I don't know a lot about like shipyards, shipping containers. How common is it for just like container upon container to just be left vacant in the middle of the night, completely empty?
Because
this is a common motif.
You see it a lot in movies and TV for sure. It could stand to read, like, you know, in between shipping stuff, you got to put the containers somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's not like they're very easy to pick up and run off with. So maybe they just leave them in the shipping yard. I have no idea.
It's just not one of those things you ever really think about, or certainly I never think about, like, where do they put the empty shipping containers
unless
when
you're
they're
watching
not shipping
like Criminal
anything.
Minds and there's a girl in the shipping container,
or 911 where they find the girl and
there's
the
a girl
container.
In the shipping container. Yes, they find the girl in mm-hmm. the shipping container, and she looks like she's been drugged, so they call in the old 118 who are just getting to the scene.
Clarifying,
they start treating her
because they never clarify this. Is this like this is a trafficking scenario, right? That's what it's giving. It's giving
that's
like
what
human
I
trafficking.
Assumed.
Yeah.
We hear. Well, that's okay. This is a little odd. We never actually find out what the guy's motivation was. I was noticing this at the end of the episode.
There's no Perry Mason wrap
like,
up.
She would have been right. They mentioned like she would have been the third girl, but it's like of a trafficking operation, of a serial killer, we just don't know.
Yeah, so...
So that was a little weird. That felt like maybe there was something cut out, or they just didn't have time to get to it.
I need to interview serial kidnapper Patrick Ryan Boyd. That's the character's real full name.
Right, right. The 118 gets there, and this girl is, like, close to maybe... going into cardiac arrest. She's like been heavily drugged. It's not clear how many times.
Eddie gets a line.
Dehydrated. Eddie gets one line. Yeah.
Yeah.
I forget what it was, but he got one.
It was something offhand like, Jesus, it's this way
or
something.
He said, I thought it was this way.
Yeah. Maybe he gets a little lost.
I think that's when I wrote in my notes Eddie's one line of the episode.
And so they're going in and, I just saw the line because I have it playing back right now. And Josh is like, he's watching, like, sort of running the show in Sue's place from, like, the bird's eye perspective. And they sync up with the cops and everything, and they get to the girl in the shipping container. Her name's Tracy, by the way. And the guy's there, by the way. They caught a glimpse of him, but then they lost him in the maze. And then you see him watching from
around
a corner.
Lurking around the scene.
And so they get to her, and they don't know exactly what she's been given, because it's just like a unlabeled syringe, and so they're like, we'll administer one dose of naloxone just to be safe, but it could be anything. It could be opium, it could be, you know, whatever. It could be bleach for all we know. She could be dying, she could be already dead, you know. She could be
meanwhile there's this crazy thing going on with Josh throughout this entire scene, because yes, he is trying to keep track of where everyone is so that they can especially help find this guy, because they don't have his location. And again, they're in this maze of the shipping containers. So he's having everyone repeat back what containers they're passing, what their location is. And he realizes this whole thing gets a little muddy for me. Like, it's hard for me to even keep track of it because it is so kind of it's interesting to have Josh remotely doing this on the phone. Mm-hmm. But basically, this is supposed to be Josh's big hero moment. Mm-hmm. He's trying to call in air support. They're like too far away. They're not coming in fast enough because they want to get like a helicopter so that they can have eyes on the bigger picture so that they can see where this guy is. But he realizes it's not going to come in time. And Josh is like, oh, location, location, location. It's the first rule of dispatching. And I don't have their location. I don't know where they are. I don't know how to save the 118.
He says a line.
The 118.
He says a line. He says, when he's establishing the perimeter, he says, let's contain the container yard, shall we? And it's like, okay.
Right.
We're about to throw down.
Yeah, he wants to establish a perimeter. But eventually... eventually something bad happens where the evil guy finds the 118's shipping container. Well, Josh notifies them. Okay, I can't remember what order this happens
okay,
in.
Okay, so let's wait. So let's go through this. So he decides to set the perimeter, right? And he tells Linda to call in air support. He starts playing.
Everybody let's thank the Lord that we don't get a Tommy Kennard cameo here.
Thank the Lord, air support never came. Jamal is working on SWAT, but they're 10 minutes out. He's trying to direct them all from his big mothership computer there. He's tapping on the keyboard, and he has pedals switching between which cop thing he's talking to, which radio frequency he's on. And he's playing it, and as I'm watching him like going through this whole thing, it's like this very fast paced thing. You're seeing him tapping away, pressing the pedals in his usual hammy way. And it dawned on me, Josh isn't just the gay coworker. Josh isn't just the coworker who stepped up. Josh is the Liberace of 911 dispatch. Josh is,
wow.
He is, you know, running the whole show, a foot on the pedal, and doing it in very he said homophobically flamboyant fashion. It's thrilling to watch. I was loving this for him. But yeah, the air support never arrives. SWAT never arrives. And the guy is evading the cops because it is a absolute maze of different shipping containers, right? And they get lost, mm-hmm. and they are not calling in their numbers. And so Josh, in the most bewildering moment of the episode, where I was like, rethink this,
Josh has what can only be described as a BBC Sherlock-style Mind Palace montage. That's really what it evoked for me. The camera's spinning around him.
And
there's like graphics coming up on the screen of all the different things he's got in his mind, like his own dialogue, sometimes from moments before in the episode is replaying in his head, the dialogue of the officers. We get like a really goofy aerial shot where he's seeing like the whole scene of all the shipping containers. Mm-hmm. And that's when it dawns on him. We will be their eyes in the sky. We are the dispatchers, and we're important, and we're first responders. So I, Josh Russo, temporary boss, will figure it out.
You see the numbers of the containers that he knows come up, along with like a map of like the entire thing. Suspect sightings, LAPD officer, LAFD is here, etc. And as he's mapping it out in his like autistic mind palace, in the eve of his meltdown, it dawns on him. He realizes what he's doing, because he's seen every equation. He realizes that what he's doing is not evading the police. He's circling back to where she is being held, where the 118
is. He has a really funny
and there are no cops there.
Where we see it on his face dawn on him, and then he goes, "No."
And so what happens is Bobby gets shot and dies. No, I'm just kidding. He tells them to
lock themselves in the
container.
The 118 is now taking, is now under fire. Because, mm-hmm. yeah, he tells them right at the last minute, lock yourselves in the container. He's circling back. And, yeah, the guy sees them, starts shooting at him right as Bobby closes the door. The bullets appear to be going through the door, but everybody gets down and nobody gets shot.
Yeah.
For now.
Eventually, you know, they do their little cop thing where like they know where he is, so they just get in there and they get him surrounded and they get him on the ground and they kick his gun away and they arrest him and the day is saved and everyone's fine and the woman's fine and they get her into the ambulance and Josh saved the day because he's a hero.
Josh,
and we love him.
The day.
Go
there's
Josh.
A lot of like there's a lot of Josh really rapid fire giving people locations and guiding mm-hmm. everybody to each other. And I was like, this is how I feel working in the grocery store deli sometimes, because it can be this fast paced and this stressful. And sometimes I'm juggling this many things. So yeah. I personally think that grocery store deli workers should also be included as first responders.
I would also add waiters to that list, because I had a nightmare last night. I had a nightmare last night that I was in my restaurant and it was pretty busy, and it was just me on the floor and my boss judging me as I was taking all of these orders and making all of the drinks myself and serving them. And it was taking a million years, and I had like the Duvel beer glasses to make like pina coladas and daiquiris in, which is so weird, and nobody liked the drinks, and they waited like 15 minutes to have their order taken, and I was having a nightmare about it, and I woke up in a cold sweat, and I'm like, why am I so physically uncomfortable in this moment? And I realized I had fallen asleep with the window open, and it was 20 degrees outside. And I was like, let me close this fucking window.
That just goes to show you are literally experiencing PTSD from your job, which is why all food service workers should count as first responders. But anyway, yes, Josh manages to save the day.
But comes in like, did you know that in most states, food service workers are not counted as first responders?
Not considered as first responders.
It only changed in California last year.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be California. It would probably be something random like Rhode Island or something.
Yeah, yeah. Nebraska. But we get one last moment in the 2006 flashback where Josh is now a visitor getting a tour of the dispatch center. And the minute he sees Sue Blevins, he shows up, he gives her a big hug. He's like, you're the voice that saved my life.
That wig.
And Sue's like, okay.
That wig. And I will say, Josh is wearing a very cute shirt in this flashback. It's like a cute little, like, it has like black cuffs on the sleeves. It's short sleeve, black trim mm-hmm. on the collar. And then it's just like a white with like black dots button down and white buttons. I thought it was so cute. I would wear this shirt. It's so, yeah, I like his vibe. But this is sort of the beginning of his Proby Josh era.
I'm sorry, I just realized part of what is unsettling about Sue Blevins's wig. It's like the exact same style and texture as the short wig that Hannah Baker wears in 13 Reasons Why cut her hair.
Oh no.
It looks it might be the same wig for all we know.
I am looking at it. It does. I thought you were going to say
inverted bob with the wavy curly texture.
I thought you were going to say perfect. It's the same like cut and trim as that bad wig Hen wore in Hen Begins when she was a pharmaceutical sales rep.
No, but that would be funny if they reused that wig.
No, this is pure Hannah Baker. Wow,
it's literally like the swooped bangs that they've sort of just clipped on the side.
Yeah.
This must be like, if not the same wig, because like they are different colors, this comes from the same wig company or something.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a name for this style.
This looks like a wig that Serena Chacha would scam a bunch of drag queens out of their money on. But I guess, you know, if you know, you know. Mm-hmm. Josh, he says to Sue, you know, she's like, you ever thought about joining up? He says, oh no, I'm just a freelance stenographer. She's like, oh, it's a real thing. And like, I believe you, Josh, that it's a real thing. I just don't believe that you're happy. And she sees that, and he sees that too. And, so he's like, what if I came and did what you did every day? And the rest is history.
Right. She's like, you have experience typing and listening. And that's all you need.
That's all you need.
So
no other personality requirements.
Josh Begins.
Josh could have become the next Gloria if he kept his little sassy pre-woke, pre-Glee gay era, you know, going
right.
on. But instead,
we have Glee to thank that that he turned out all right.
Yeah, but instead, Sue lives back in the present. Sue lives, and she looks so. Mm-hmm. I love this actress. She just radiates so much like joy and warmth.
Yes,
I love
and
her.
She definitely looks better without that wig.
Yes, we get her with her real hair, and she looks so correct. And then we see the flashback, flashback of
hers.
They're sort of bantering
where Josh is like, who tries to stop a kidnapping off the clock? And, you know, she's like, well, I didn't exactly plan it. And then we get this flashback of what she actually did see. Mm-hmm. She basically saw the guy's car and she saw that there was this clearly drugged, unconscious woman kind of head lolling in the passenger seat. So mm-hmm. she obviously got concerned, got out of the car, went over to him like, stop, stop.
And then he just creamed her.
I feel like if I were Sue Blevins, I don't mean to, you know, question Sue Blevins's abilities here, but she was already on the phone with Josh. I feel like I would have either alerted Josh if he was at work or called 911 firstly, because could she not think, you know, with all her years of experience as like a dispatcher and kind of a crisis manager, could she not have thought, you know, if I get out of the car and confront this man who appears to have kidnapped a woman, he might either panic and try to get away and hurt me like he did, mm-hmm. or, you know, I just feel like if she had just quietly called 911, tried to get the license plate number, I feel like she should have known that. But for plot reasons, she had to confront him and get hit by a car.
Maybe she had had a really long day. Maybe she was like at the end of her rope. And she was looking forward mm-hmm. to like a nice movie night with Dawn. And she saw this mm-hmm. and she was like, let me handle this myself. Because you know what it's like at the end of like a really long shift. And there's like a moment of like crisis or whatever. And you're just like, let me take off my apron and deal with this. You know what I mean?
Right.
I feel like that was like the energy she was giving me.
Or maybe like there was someone working at dispatch that night that she didn't like. And she like wanted to avoid having to talk with him on the phone.
Yo, what if it was May? What if Sue had like one-sided May Grant beef?
She would never.
She would
partly
never.
Because May does have one-sided beef with someone else in season 5, and it's not Sue.
Maybe when that happens, Sue, like, you know, she starts coalition building with the one-sided beef lady, and she's like, ugh, this one, right? You know?
May asks Josh, is the girl okay? And Josh
says,
she's safe. Sue, pardon me. All of these names sort of run together. One syllable, three letter names.
All those dispatcher workers, you know?
Tracy's mom shows up to the hospital.
Tracy's
McFarty
mom's
lets her into the
got
hospital
it
room.
Going on. I want. Okay. Right. So.
They reunite.
The reunion is so emotional because this actress who's playing Tracy's mom is like really selling it, and I genuinely shed a tear, and I got so frustrated that for the first time in this show we didn't get to see the reunion like from the perspective
right.
of like
they didn't
the,
even play like an emotional
people.
Montage of them growing up together,
and like it would have been the first time in the show if they had that it would have worked on me properly, but you know they didn't, so you know, I guess they left me wanting more, which I guess is a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
Well, at the Grant household elsewhere, mm-hmm. Athena has not changed her mind. She's sitting with May and she's like, I haven't changed my mind about letting you move out, but because this week freaked me out, I have printed out a truly ridiculous list of demands, advice, lists of reasonable neighborhoods I will let you move into. Here's all my conditions, like 20 pages of conditions. But other than that, yeah, you can move out.
One of the non-negotiable conditions was no balconies. And
yeah, that seems a little unfair.
I guess like someone can sneak into a balcony, but like if May's on like the 9th floor or whatever of like a high rise,
I imagined that she was considering it a safety hazard because like May could fall off the balcony.
Like she's,
I don't know.
Like she's 5. Like I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm
or
sorry.
Like an evil person could push her off her balcony.
I heard no balconies and I got bummed. I was like, oh, no balcony for May.
She doesn't even get to like smoke on her balcony. What's
I
up
know.
With that?
Well, Athena wouldn't let her do that either. Like I feel like
but
she would
be in her own place, so it wouldn't matter.
Yeah, yeah. I like the really gauche part of my brain went to, you know, we just had the revisiting of the unalivement attempt. What if Athena was concerned about balconies for other reasons? And then I was like, that would be crazy.
That would be crazy. Also, I can't believe you said unalivement.
Listen, I don't...
I want you to cut that out just for that.
I'll censor me saying that, and then only you and I will know that I said unalivement.
No, I would just like you to remove it. But May's like, yay, I get to move out, whatever.
I'll bad ADR it, and I'll say suicide. On like a noisy
Please
street.
Please don't do any of that. But May's like, okay, great. I guess I'm moving out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, thanks, Mom. And then Buck is home in his apartment watching Taylor Kelly on TV. And who should walk through his door but Taylor Kelly? She's like, yeah, that's a rerun.
Have you ever seen Taylor Kelly and Taylor Kelly in the same room at the same time? Taylor Kelly on TV is like her Hannah Montana persona.
She shows up. Oh, that'd be great. She shows up with a bottle of champagne. She's like, it was a gift from my boss because he's so pleased with my work. And Buck's like, oh, great. So you must be getting a promotion. And she's like, well, sure, but that's not what we're celebrating. We're celebrating justice. Mm-hmm. And that girl is safe. And so this is supposed to be in contrast to Taylor being so evil and selfish in season two. This is supposed to show us that Buck is realizing that, wow, she's changed. Mm-hmm. Which is fine. I almost wish she were still more evil.
Yeah.
But it's fine.
I mean, that's part of the joy of Taylor as a character. I love a character who's just like a little bit sinister. You know.
And there's also, this might sound crazy, but there's almost something kind of patriarchal to me about the way that this scene is meant to show us that she's been tamed.
Oh, yeah.
And Buck, you know, smiles at her in this approving way. And it's like, oh, great. Now she's fit for dating.
We have to
now
tone down the career
bring
woman.
Bring home to Mom.
You know, we have to bring home to Buck's mom. Right. Yeah. no, it's like,
honestly, Taylor Kelly might be the only match for Margaret Buckley. She could probably go toe to toe and leave the Buckley parents
so
crying
true.
At the end of the conversation.
No, so true. I would love to see
yet
that.
Another reason Tuck should be endgame.
Tuck should be endgame so that she can destroy Buck's mom and then they can be bye for bye. Taylor, I mean,
maybe they'll have an open marriage.
We know that Taylor is a very career-driven woman, so I agree with you that there is something patriarchal about, like, yeah, we have to tame her so that Buck can, you know, like, she's serviceable for him to, like, I don't know, get it in with. Yeah, it's a strange,
there's just something a little bit that gives me the ick about this moment of, like, yeah, Buck, oh, now she's okay enough. Now she's acceptable for Buck's approval, you know? Not saying she wasn't evil in season two. And, like, I get why this is here, but there's something about it that's like, man, why can't Taylor just, like, you know, why does it have to be framed as, like, oh, I've changed so that I can be more, you know, romanceable to you now?
Yeah. At least she doesn't quit her job. You know what I mean?
True.
But
that'd be really funny if instead of breaking up in season five, they're like, I quit being a journalist and I'm going to be a housewife now so that we can get married.
That would be Ryan Guzman writing the teleplay for that.
Literally.
Just making loaves of bread for my hubby every day.
I'm just going to stay at home and crank out babies, mm-hmm. which not definitely isn't a thing that you are into sexually. But anyway, another detail about this scene that I was taken with is just the fact that Buck owns champagne flutes. Like, mm-hmm. when Taylor walks in with the champagne, he goes right to his wine glass cupboard and gets out the flutes. And I was just thinking, wow, he's really come far from his frat boy days.
Yeah. Yeah, very clean champagne flutes too. I mean, sure, it's a production thing, but there was not a
not
water
a smudge
stain
on
them.
Them,
not a smudge, you know, and very well,
you know,
organized.
You know that, like, in season one, if Abby had come over with a bottle of sparkling wine, he would have been like, oh yeah, babe, wait a second, and just pulled two, like, used red Solo cups out of the trash.
Let me get the souvenir Springsteen cup I got at the concert with Bobby.
Let me get my Dune popcorn bucket I took home from the theater and just pour the wine into this, and we'll share, like, a big trough.
Yeah, and then we'll save it for later. Anyways, he has champagne flutes, and that's nice, and presumably they have all kinds of freaky sex all over the apartment until 4 in the morning. The next day, Sue Blevins...
Or maybe they just stayed up and talked, about their feelings, because that's the kind of girl Taylor is now.
God, stop.
But yes, at dispatch, Sue is back to work. She's healthy again. She's healthy enough to come back to work, and everyone applauds as she walks in. And mm-hmm. Maddie has arranged this little thing where she talks into the walkie-talkie, and she's like, "Dispatcher Blevins, you know, state your status or something, advise mm-hmm. your status." And Sue, very emotionally, kind of choked up, she talks into the walkie-talkie. She goes, "Dispatcher Sue Blevins, back for service, or back in service."
Mm-hmm.
And everybody claps, and a bunch of people on dispatch, like members of the 118, including Eddie, who gets his second line of the mm-hmm. episode, says like, "You rock, Blevins, welcome back." It's like, have you two ever spoken to each other?
No, they have you? Not. They
I
will.
Don't think you have.
They will eventually, and this we know.
Will they?
Well, they certainly, maybe like in the break room or something, you'll say hi. But Athena is also on there, and you know that they go way back. And it's like, "Yes, Mother. Yes, Sue. You have returned. You live." Dispatcher Blevins back in service. And then she says, "Now get back to work."
Now back to work. And then we get, literally, this is like they decided to have Jennifer Love Hewitt earn her check for this episode mm-hmm. because they end the episode with Maddie sitting back down. And as she does constantly, this is one of my drinking game mm-hmm. rules, she tears up, she's all choked up, but she answers the phone and she goes, "911, what's your emergency?" Through the tears.
And that is how it ends.
And that's how it ends.
Iconic. Iconic episode.
Iconic.
Listen, this episode had problems. This episode had room for growth and improvement. That was very indicative of the show as a whole. Helmstever, as a whole. This episode mm-hmm. was an eat. I'm sorry. I loved this episode. It was so good.
No, I love this one too. It's a classic.
Yeah.
I love the presence of Taylor in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I love the focus on Sue because we have always liked Sue.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, I may not always unironically like the Josh stuff, but I always enjoy it at the very least on a camp level.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So I enjoyed that.
Yeah. All in all, I thought this episode was gripping in the way that it should have been. I thought the mystery storyline was really well crafted, and I loved the way that all the storylines fed into each other. I thought the only storyline that was disconnected from the main plot, which was the Athena May thing, was also really well done because it was, again, a rare moment of genuine like personal growth and introspection on this show.
Mm-hmm.
So that was good. It was good. It was a well done episode. I appreciated it. I enjoyed it.
What if we called this episode Tuck Everlasting?
Oh, have to. I was gonna suggest McFarty McFly, but you know, I think Tuck Everlasting is also.
But McFly was the name of Chimney's crow buddy.
Oh, you're right. Maybe that's the next ship. McFarty and the Crow.
Interesting.
Very innovative,
thanks for
I think.
Tuning into this episode of the First Risk Podcast, everybody. Also known as the First Podcasters. It's been another great week, and you know, we just just like 2 weeks ago, released our latest Patreon episode where we actually watched the Lone Star crossover episode with our good buddy Justin Gross. It's on the Patreon right now. Mm-hmm. Our bonus episode topic poll is live, or maybe it's not by the time this releases. I don't know. Ryan loves to promise that certain things will or won't be live on the Patreon, and then I'm the one who usually updates the Patreon, and I'm like, man, it's not ready yet. But surely we will have some Patreon episode in the works for this month sometime.
Yes. So with that being said, thank you guys for supporting our show. And if you want to support us further, follow us on social media at First Risk Podcast, spelled how it sounds. And have a lovely, lovely night, everybody. Don't forget to go out to the movie theater to support your local cinemas, to support
local
movies.
Theaters. I, for one, am going out to Five Nights at Freddy's 2
nice.
With my friends tomorrow.
Oh, so
I'm
fun.
Doing my part.
Very
I'm gonna
nice.
Sneak in a bunch of buzz balls.
Nice. I'm planning on seeing Hamnet, the new Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley movie about Shakespeare's dead son. So that'll be fun.
Yeah.
I heard it was really great.
Spoilers.
Spoilers for the life of William Shakespeare. You're right. How could I have been so naive? So with that, thanks for listening, guys. I don't have a remember to say, so I guess I'll just say remember to spay and neuter your friends and neighbors. Take care, everyone.
I don't like it when you say that.